This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
There's an awful lot of learning and training going on in colleges and universities across the U.S., but according to a new book, not a lot of thinking.
If you offer them the opportunity to think rather than simply perform, a lot of them take it very quickly.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear why this educator says, why teach? We'll also hear from the mother of a 14-year-old literal genius who has never expected to be able to tie his own shoes and spend an academic minute imaging an emotional brain. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Mark Edmondson is a renowned professor of English at the University of Virginia. He would love to see America's colleges and universities transform from what he sees as the home of high-priced tuition, career training, and interactive online courses back to the place where serious people go to broaden their minds and learn to live the rest of their lives. In his new book, Why Teach? In Defense of a Real Education, Mark uses a series of essays to convey the picture he sees and the one he'd like to see in American higher education. I spoke with Professor Edmondson recently and asked why he chose to tell his story by using a group of essays.
Well, because, you know, essays are a little bit like a dish of pistachio nuts. You can eat one or two or three, but the author hopes that you're going to eat them all. And they're supposed to be a little bit more entertaining than a hardcore, straight-at-you academic book. And I hope that I'd be read by students and members of the general public, as well as some of my colleagues in the profession. So essays and a collection of essays seem to make sense.
How long have you been writing these?
Well, the first of these essays appeared in 1997, when I was a good deal younger than I am. So my math is shaky, but a little more than 15 years.
Well, I guess we'll get to the meat of it. What is fundamentally wrong with education the way you see it?
Well, I guess people expect education to be all about training and pre-corporate preparation and getting ready for a job. And if those things are a byproduct of education, I don't mind. But I think the humanities are more about getting to know yourself and figuring out what the world is about. And based on that, coming to some understanding of what you want to do with the rest of your life.
Do you think that today's students are equipped to think instead of learn?
Most of the students I have jumped through a lot of hoops on their way to the University of Virginia. My buddy Bill Dershowitz quotes one of them saying, "We're excellent sheep." But there's an upside to that. That is, they're well-prepared, they're good readers and pretty good writers, and if you offer them the opportunity to think rather than simply perform, a lot of them take it very quickly.
You wrote in one of your essays that the enemy of knowledge is knowingness. Do a lot of students today think that they already know it all because of all the technology they're good at?
I think that, you know, the people who come on the nightly news and you see them on YouTube, and they kind of suggest by way of their irony and their confidence that they know everything that's worth knowing. And sometimes students are interested in mimicking that pose. But mostly people who are young now, I mean, my students, they want to take the prerogative of being young, and that means being open to other possibilities. And knowing this pretty quickly melts away when you say, well, you know, we're feeling knowing, but what do you think about Plato here? And then knowing this kind of melts away. And they got to start talking to the great works, you know, the best that's been known and thought. And a lot of good things happen based on that.
I'll let you tell this story, but your father gave you some good advice that, well, seemed to have been good advice when you were trying to choose what to do in college. What was that?
That's a nice story, at least for me. When I was about to go to the University of Massachusetts, my father said, well, what courses are you going to sign up for? And I said, well, I think I'd like to be pre-law. And my father said, are you interested in being a lawyer? And I said, well, no, but I heard lawyers make good money. And my father, who had some experience with lawyers, and I dare say a couple of policemen too, got very mad at me. And he said, but do you really want to be a lawyer? And I said, I don't really know. And he said, but you're interested in literature and writing, right? And I said, I am. I really am. And he said, well, why don't we sign up for a few literature courses? And we did. And that was very good advice, especially coming from somebody who hadn't been to college and who didn't really have any advantages at all. But he had a good instinct for what a real education was about.
And he told you that you're only going to college once, so you better make it count.
Yes, he did. That's right. That's right. He said, you know, if you have some secret information, special information that the reincarnation thing is true and you're going to be able to go through life 30 or 40 times, you might as well be pre-law. But since you may only get one shot, you might as well do what you want to do.
In one of these essays, you brilliantly bring together William Blake, Hulk Hogan, and Satan. Well done, I have to say.
Thank you.
How did that one come together? Because that one was really put together in a kind of, I wouldn't say odd, but different way.
Yeah. Well, you know, my wife is a fiction writer, and so I sometimes experiment with bringing a kind of what you might call a semi-artistic dimension into my writing, and I like to weave together stories about my own life and stories about what I've been reading and stories about people that I know. And in this case, it was a story about William Blake's great poem, Milton, and some events that were going on at the John Paul Jones Arena, and my own perplexity about how to defend the humanities. It's a bit of a long story, but I was glad to be able to bring those things together. But not for nothing is it the last essay in the book. It's the most demanding, and I'm really glad that you got there.
Well, and it brings to light that, too, that universities do have to become profit centers at this point, sometimes to the detriment of teaching.
Yeah, well, they surely feel the economic pressure upon them. There's no doubt about that. And I think students feel it. And as a father of two students, or one of whom is in the process of going to school, I surely feel it because I'm paying the bills. And, of course, I would like to see us think about some ways to cut college costs in the process of enhancing education. I might like to see us question how many administrators we need and how many varsity football teams we need to put in the field and how many sports centers and gymnasiums we really require. I think there are some ways to cut, and also, I dare say, how much faculty members need to be paid. So I think we've got to ask all of those questions on the way to making education a little bit more affordable for the people who most need it.
Is the education that many of the students are getting today actually worth the price tag?
Well, I can say with confidence that the education that my Virginia students get at the University of Virginia for $10,000 worth of tuition per term is about the best buy in the United States of America. It hurts me that our out-of-state students pay as much as they do, and I would like to see ways that we could work to make them have to pay less. One of the problems is that my state, which has many good things going for it, Virginia, has been decreasing its support of public education for the last 20 years. They used to pay a large segment of our bill, and really, you know, enforce Thomas Jefferson's dream. That's the founder of my school, Thomas Jefferson. And now it's unpopular. The legislators don't want to do it, and more of the burden falls on the students.
Where do we go from here? What's next for education in America? Is it just going to plod along the way you see it going, or are there a new generation of teachers and administrators who are going to bring it forward and back to thinking instead of just memorizing?
We're going to have a struggle, and it's starting right now, it seems to me. And the struggle is going to be between, and this is a distinction that the great philosopher John Dewey made, education for society as against education for the individual. And education for society means getting people ready to fill roles that they may or may not want to fill for the betterment of collective life. Education for the individual means getting people in a position to decide what they want to do with their lives, whether they hope to be rich or poor, whether they want to pursue success or whether they want to pursue what Thoreau called voluntary poverty. I'm clearly on what you'd call the latter side. And I think one of the good things about these educational debates that have been coming up recently is that we're going to have to fight this out now. And I'm hoping that my side wins. But victory is not assured.
Again, the name of Mark Edmondson's new book is Why Teach? In Defense of a Real Education. It's published by Bloomsbury.
Christine Barnett's son Jacob has an IQ higher than Einstein's, a photographic memory, and he taught himself calculus in 2 weeks.
At age 9, he started working on an original theory in astrophysics that experts believe someday may lead to a Nobel Prize. But at age 2, experts said he would never be able to tie his own shoes. But the story of Christine's journey with Jacob is all the more remarkable because his extraordinary mind was almost lost to autism. Christine Barnett's new book is called The Spark, A Mother's Story of Nurturing Genius. She recently spoke with the Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue, who asked when she realized she actually was nurturing genius.
Well, you know what's funny is when Jacob was a very young child, back when he was still talking to us, still looking us in the eyes, before he really fell into this dark world of autism. At that point, there were these little highlights, things that he did that I saw that were remarkable. He was able to recite the alphabet forwards and backwards when he was 1 year old. He was able to play music by ear from a little toy piano in a music store by our house. So he was doing remarkable things as a baby, but then when he was 2 years old, Jacob was diagnosed with moderate to severe autism. He stopped talking. He stopped looking us in the eyes. And we were told at that time by experts that the most we should expect for him was just life skills, things like buttoning his coat and tying his shoes, and to worry about what to do when we were gone someday, to worry about what he would be like as an adult and what support he would need to live.
When you have that kind of diagnosis and that is told to you, I'm curious because you get this idea in the book that you learned what was possible for him through him, in the sense of you were not introducing him to things. He was just sort of naturally moving from one thing to another and mastering things like calculus in a matter of weeks.
Right. Well, you know what's funny is the surprise about my story is that what I found out worked for Jacob actually works for every child. I was running a little daycare at the time that I was working with Jacob, and I applied some of these principles to all of the children. And so in a sense, I actually have more experience with typical children than I do with, you know, with Jacob, who is a prodigy. But every single time in every single child that I worked with, I saw them do something amazing. And it's all very simple. The key is in how children learn. The key is just a shift from focusing on what children can't do to what they love and what their innate gifts and talents are. So it's not just Jacob's story. It's actually a story that is about all of our children and the brilliant potential that occurs in each of them.
So what do you feel you were able to give Jacob and these other children that put them at an advantage?
Well, what saved my son when he was deep in this world of autism was to stop focusing on the things that were difficult for him and the things that he was struggling with. He was enrolled in a very intensive therapy program where he had over 40 hours a week of therapy. He had a therapy team consisting of an occupational therapist, a physical therapist, a developmental pediatrician, a speech therapist. These were just maybe not even a third of the team of people who were working with him at the time. And all of the people who were working with him had this checklist of skills. And it was a checklist of things like looking people in the eye, small motor skills like stacking rings, large motor skills like putting one foot in the front of the other, going up a set of stairs. And with their focus on all of these things that were difficult for Jacob, taking up so much of his day, what I realized was the things that Jacob was actually good at, the things that I had seen in him before he disappeared into that world of autism, things like the alphabet, they were being completely ignored. And what I think is very important and why I'm so glad you have me on the show today is I think we're doing this to our children, all of our children. And I think we worry about what is the future of the children in our country. We compare their test scores to other children in other countries, and we worry that they might be lagging behind. And I feel like there is a brilliant potential in our children, And we are doing exactly what we were what the therapists were doing with my child in a special ed setting. We're doing that to all of the children in our school system. We're giving them a checklist every year, a checklist of things they need to do, a checklist of their math skills, a checklist of their reading skills. And what we're failing to do is believe in the things that they are each brilliant at, the things they were doing as a young child, like taking apart the backs of their TVs as little boys with screwdrivers, little girls going off to daycare and telling brilliant magical stories. We're not focusing on that. We're just focusing on things that I think are not reflecting the true potential within each of our children.
Still to come, Joe Donahue's conversation with Christine Barnett continues with a look at Jacob's future. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1195. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Christine Barnett, mother of a 12-year-old son who is working on his doctorate in physics. She's speaking with The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue about her son and her new book, The Spark, A Mother's Story of Nurturing Genius. And Joe asked if she still considers Jacob a child with autism.
Well, you know, Jacob has struggled with autism throughout his life. And the remarkable thing about Jacob is he is able to take that label and just shatter it. And I think that the danger when we put a label on any person is that it will set a ceiling for what they're able to do. So Jacob has definitely exceeded anybody, even world experts' opinions of what a person with autism should be able to achieve. However, he still faces that disorder every day. He has a lot of trouble with, for example, the lights in the classroom he's in. If it's a cloudy day, the way that reflections bounce off of things, his senses don't process things the way that other people's do. So the courageous thing about Jacob is that he still does face autism every day, and he overcomes it every day.
And what you're saying is that while that exists, you still have to take what he is able to accomplish and harness that energy and that spectacular skill and use it to the advantage of not only him, but for us as a culture.
Yeah, I think that the autism is not in the forefront anymore. The label of autism is not what people think of when they think of Jacob. They think of this brilliant scientist. He's the world's youngest published astrophysics researcher. His work's in the Smithsonian and NASA. People don't look at him and just only see autism anymore. And that's so important for people, all people who have autism or any type of developmental disorder, to not allow that label to define who they are and become this overwhelming thing that sort of tells you what your potential as a person is. And then further, for all of us, we cannot let our fears about our children define our children. You know, we need to start believing in these teachers who have gone to school and who have educated themselves. Instead of giving them this little checklist every year and saying, this is our only expectations for our children. And I say our only expectations, because we think, oh, by doing this, we're going to make sure that everybody meets everything. Everybody's going to be a little bit good at everything. And nobody's going to be great at any one thing. And we're not letting our teachers be great at what they are capable of. We're not believing in them as professionals. And we're just we're losing hope, much like I lost hope for my child when he was a little boy under the autism diagnosis. We're losing hope for our children and for our country's future.
And
we don't have to.
You end the book by quoting one of Jacob's physics professors, who says he can do anything he wants, and that's the takeaway really from the book, right? That anything he wants to do, he can do.
Yes. I mean, it's so simple. I want people to go out and get the book and read it, and you don't have to be wealthy. You don't have to pay special tutors. You don't have to do, you know, intensive programs or take classes. I want people to go and just kind of get this little shift, a little change in how we look at things. That's all it takes. It's very simple, and it can really change the potential for each of our children. I want a world where people are not just looking at Jacob as a child who's loving and doing math and physics, but we're looking at our culture as full of children who are each able, not maybe to necessarily rise to the level of prodigy, but each able to make unique and wonderful contributions to the world of math and science and art. And I think by doing what we love, that's the key.
Again, the name of Christine Barnett's new book is The Spark, A Mother's Story of Nurturing Genius. She spoke with the Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue. Brain imaging is telling scientists a lot about human emotions. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I am Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Improvements in brain imaging technology have taught us a great deal, but will they ever be able to tell us what a subject is thinking or feeling? Karim Kassam, assistant professor of social and decision science at Carnegie Mellon University, describes efforts to create brain activity signatures for a range of emotional states.
Emotional experience pervades every aspect of mental life. Emotions influence our memories and perceptions as well as our decisions and actions. When emotional processing gets out of whack, a number of problems result. Everyone agrees that emotion is important. Surprisingly, though, researchers don't have a solid grasp of precisely what emotion is. We don't know what processes give rise to emotion, we're not sure how different emotions relate to one another, and we don't know how emotion is represented in the brain. In order to address these gaps in our understanding, my colleagues and I conducted an fMRI experiment. We recruited professional actors and had them imagine being in different emotional states while we scanned their brains. Why actors? We wanted to study a broad range of emotions, and actors are adept at rapidly entering and exiting emotional states on cue. The results tell us a lot about emotion. We found that the neural signatures of emotion were common across people and across different types of emotional experience. And we were able to inspect those neural signatures to see how the brain represents emotion. We found that anger looks more similar to happiness than any other negative emotion, possibly because both angry and happy individuals tend to approach the source of their emotion. And we found that lust looked unlike any other emotion. It was represented by a unique pattern of neural activation that was hard to confuse with anything else. Beyond what they tell us about the structure of emotion, the results also suggest a method of measuring it. Existing methods, like looking at people's heart rate or blood pressure, examining their facial expression, or simply asking them how they feel, all have their flaws. Our research suggests, for the first time, that we can use neuroscience to accurately measure people's emotional states.
That was Karim Kassam of Carnegie Mellon University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.